I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. My chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers to hear their stories, what inspired their creations, what decisions changed their careers, and what relationships influenced their work. Here's the thing. For some people, destiny arrives early, hands them a map, and clears a path toward the future. For others, destiny shows up later while they're still kicking around in the woods. My guests today, Dick Cavett and Kristen Wiig, took two very different journeys, but both ended up right where they were meant to be. As a little boy, Dick Cavett loved to talk.
A month ago on this table, when I was going through old envelopes of stuff, I found three report cards. Dick must learn to control his talking is on two of them. Dick must learn to let others talk occasionally, one of the wittier ones put down.
And when his family finally got a television, he fell in love with that too. It was only a matter of time before Cavett would combine the two with a talk show that generated some of the medium's greatest moments.
How come you didn't kiss me then when you came out if I'm so...
Well, let's see, this is the third show. Hmm? By the fifth show, we'll give each other a hell of a kiss when I come out.
Oh, yeah.
But let's say you happened to meet my first guest, Kristen Wiig, when she was in college. If you brought up the idea of her acting, let alone being on Saturday Night Live, she'd probably stare at you blankly. Yet Lorne Michaels has called Wiig one of the best performers in SNL history. She has changed the conversation about women in comedy, so it's hard to believe Wiig's career almost didn't happen.
I was an art major. It wasn't really for me. I was kind of in my, I hate the word party phase. I hate that word. I was having fun, I guess, at that time.
Yeah.
And I...
taking it easy.
I was taking it easy. And then I didn't really know what I was having, like, what am I going to do with my life?
You were in your ring-a-ding-ding phase.
I've never used that term, but I'm going to. And then I went back to Rochester because I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. And then I just started, like, taking classes at the local community college. And then
for
I was
what?
Like, I want to travel. Art. Right. Art classes.
And there's no performance element in what you're doing all this
God,
time.
Oh, God, no.
And were people
no.
saying to you, God, you're funny? I don't think people wake up when they're 25 and they're funny.
You know what? I never really did plays. I mean, if I had to give a speech in class, I would try anything to get out of it. I hated talking in front of people. I still actually don't really like doing that. If I'm myself and it's a group of people, it still makes me nervous. Anyway, after I was back in Rochester, I did a Knowles semester. Do you know what that is? It's like Outward Bound, where you like live outside and learn.
Is it like meaningful or is it ring-a-ding-ding?
No, it's meaningful.
It is.
Yeah.
People are like camping.
Soul searching.
And they're
yes.
soul searching.
Oh, yes, of course. For 3 months.
They're not six-pack searching.
There was a little bit of that.
So it's called a what?
Knowles, National Outdoor Leadership School. You're laughing at me. It's like Outward Bound.
Outdoor leadership. I like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was
outdoor.
Like you learn how to live outside and like—
Just in case of the apocalypse.
Yeah, and if you get lost in the woods, like I would know what to do. And if I was with you, I
right.
would bring up this conversation and say you're on your own.
Yeah, you go get lost in the woods. I'm going to be in the hotel watching Bridesmaids on pay-per-view.
Anyway, long Knowles. Story short, after that, went back to Rochester and then applied to the University of Arizona. Went there for a year.
Why there?
It was a boyfriend thing.
Okay.
And then...
So you're a pretty normal kid up until now.
Pretty normal, yeah.
And then?
Then I took an acting class.
Where?
At University of Arizona.
You did.
My major was studio art, and you could pick three different types of art for that major. And it was like sculpture, painting, and I just tried this class called performance art, which was very like... writing poems and doing
Karen
kind of...
Finley.
Yes, like very weird light yes. changes and things like that. It was literally acting 101.
That was one class.
One class. And I was terrified to take it because I, like I said, I hate standing up in front of people and performing. But something about this class, we learned about improv and my teacher was really supportive. And at the end of the class, he was just like, have you ever considered doing this? And I was like, no, yeah, right.
So it was your teacher that played
it? It was my teacher, yeah. I just kept thinking about it and I wasn't really happy there. I didn't really like the art program wasn't really for me. I don't want to say I had an epiphany, but I did have one of those moments where I was, like, looking at myself in the mirror, and I was like, what are you doing? What do you want to do? If you could do anything in this world, what would it be? And I was like, I want to move to L.A. and try to be an actor.
You do.
Which was crazy, but I didn't stop myself. I packed my car, like, the next day, and my roommate at the time in Arizona lived in Beverly Hills, and she said I could come stay with her.
So it all started flowing in that direction.
Yeah, I didn't tell my parents that I was leaving
Arizona.
You kept
sending letters to the post office in Tucson?
And I just kept saying, God, it's really hot here. Oh, there's so much sand everywhere.
But they're postmarked West Hollywood.
Yes, exactly. West Hollywood, Arizona.
And when you got there, how quickly did you get into the Groundlings thing?
Not quickly, because I moved there and I was like, I need to get
it. You kind of move at a glacial pace, don't you? You were kind of creeping up on this, weren't you?
I got there and I was like, what
am
I?
It's a slow motion epiphany.
Yeah, it was an epiph. I got there and I was like, what am I doing? Because L.A. is a city of actors and performers and writers and filmmakers for the most part. I mean, that's where they all go. And I had zero experience. I wasn't, you know, 19, and I just, like, got a job and, like, wasn't really doing anything.
Got a job doing what?
I worked at Anthropology.
Did you?
The store, yeah.
You sold clothes at Anthropology?
Yeah, and I did, like...
Or were you security?
I wasn't security. No, but I did a lot of, like, visual stuff because of my art background. I helped with, like, the, you know...
Displays
and stuff.
But when you say you weren't sure what you were doing, there's something about you in the time I've known you and been around you where you're still kind of that way.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I'm ever going to figure it out.
Right.
I don't know. Do you ever? I don't know.
I mean, I think that there's two types of people in the business that I've met. There's the ones that have that very Mickey Rooney kind of, I'm going to be in show business, you know, since they're kids and they just want it and they eat, sleep, and drink it. Then there's people who are, if not accidental, they certainly have a sense that they're visiting. Well, I'll do this for now, you know.
Yeah. I love performing, but there's such a big part of me that's like, don't look at me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's hard to find that balance. I think also, like, people assume if you're an actor that you just, like, walk into a room and you're like, hello, listen to this story. I want everyone to gather around.
Attention, everyone.
Yeah,
attention.
And I'm the exact opposite.
Yeah.
If I'm in a room full of people and someone says, like, hey, Kristen, what happened at that thing? I'll just be like, I'll start sweating.
Isn't your dream going to dinner and someone else does all the talking?
Yeah, that's why I like going to dinner with you.
That's my favorite. But so when you're there and you get into the Groundlings.
Yeah. Groundlings opened everything up.
Now, how so? Because for you, you're thinking acting and it was a performing art class. You said, I'm going to go to LA to be an actress. And do you feel that you crossed a line and it was, I'm a comedian or I'm a comedy actress? Or you never felt that way?
No, I think it was improv. It was watching people be on stage acting without a script. There was something in me that was like, I want to do that. I know that I can do that. For some reason, it was less scary to me than having words in front of me. Because I think when you're handed a script, you know that you're supposed to do it in a certain way. And people will think, like, how is she reading this? But when you're improvising, there's nothing to compare it to. And you can do whatever.
There's no Blanche DuBois.
Yeah. No. But when I started taking classes at the Groundlings and taking improv, it was like... something just, like, clicked, and I felt like, oh, this is what I want to do. And
but at the same time, did you get a sense of what you're doing? It was working. You were pretty good at it.
I mean, yeah, I think so.
I mean, that's weird to talk about myself like that. Did you just suck up until recently, but you were good?
No, I mean, it was something – it was nice to have that thing that I knew that I was good at, finally, besides art, which is very personal and quiet and – you know, that was just sort of something I did by myself. You don't talk to anybody when you're drawing or painting. It's very isolating. And for me, doing the Groundlings was the exact opposite of that because it's such a community and you improvise with other people and you have to connect with other people to make it work.
Did you audition to get in?
It's like a school. I mean, you have to go and take the first class, and then after the first class, your teacher tells you if you can move on or if you should repeat it or if this isn't for you. And then you just keep going. And then the third level is, like, it's writing intensive. So that's like, where I learned how to write was at the Groundlings.
And the Groundlings was how long?
probably like 4 or 5 years, I guess.
Yeah, a few years.
Yeah. I mean, there's time in between some of the levels because there's such a long waiting list. And then once I got into the main company, I was only in it for a handful of months before I got SNL.
Now, when SNL comes knocking, for those...
I mean, well, we knocked. I don't know if they knocked.
What do you mean?
Well, we sent it. My manager sent a tape in...
So you had an agent and a manager.
I had...
You were playing the whole thing out there.
I had a manager.
Were you working?
I'd done a few pilots, right. I guess, and a few commercials.
So you weren't cloistered over there in the Groundlings. You were working.
I was, yeah. I mean, I still had odd jobs.
And when you connected with the SNL people, you sent material to them?
Naomi sent a tape in, and then...
Your manager.
Yes, sorry, my manager, Naomi Odenkirk, who's... I wouldn't have any of my career if it wasn't for her. I used to babysit for her.
Did you?
And then I asked her to come see my Groundlings show, and she was like, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, anyway, so that's how she signed me, was from seeing me there. But she just kind of sent my tape in, and then, you know, you don't hear anything, and then you just get a call. We'd like her to audition this summer. 5 characters, 3 impressions, 5 minutes. And I was like, okay, I don't really have any impressions, so I'm going to have
you
to,
didn't.
Like, I'd never done impressions on stage at the Groundlings. Right. It was just kind of, like, joking around with my friends. Flew out there. It was the most terrifying experience.
Who was there? Who were you doing it for?
I don't even remember, like, a sea of darkness. I don't even, I just remember
was
Lauren
there?
Was there,
right.
and Seth and Marcy, Tina, you
Did
know.
Did you know any of them prior to that? Had you been friends with Tina or
oh, no,
Seth?
I hadn't met any. No. I went to New York once when I was in 8th grade yeah. and, like, went to.
Yeah. To go to court.
To, like, Hard Rock Cafe or something when I was in, like, 8th grade.
Ring-a-ding-ding.
No, I came to New York and I was like, what? I bought a stopwatch because I really thought they were going to just turn the lights off at 5 minutes. Because
right.
they said, like, it's 5 minutes.
It's 5 minutes.
Please don't go
no
over.
Kidding.
So I was like.
We're going to electrocute you.
Yeah. So I practiced in
wires.
The mirror with, like, a stopwatch trying to get it under 5 minutes, exactly 5 minutes. And I don't do stand-up. So the idea of performing by myself.
And how did it go?
I felt okay. I felt pretty good.
Yeah.
They laughed a little bit. I was warned, you know, like, it's going to be quiet.
Tough
just
crowd.
Do it. It's a tough crowd. Just do it and go. If anything, I just felt happy that I did it because I was so terrified and shaking. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. And then it was over. I didn't hear anything. Then I was like, okay, well, that was an experience. And then, like, a month and a half later, we got a call saying, can she come back? You know, and if she has new stuff or other stuff, that would be great, too. And I was like, I've crammed everything I've ever done in that 5 minutes. But then I came up with some new stuff, went back and did it again. Then they asked me to stay and meet with Lorne. I don't remember what I said.
Do you have kind of an Alzheimer's problem?
No.
Because you don't remember a lot. You don't remember
I don't remember because I do have a horrible memory. But also I was so nervous and probably didn't say much anyway. And then he was like, you know, well, we don't really have room for you right now, but, you know, your audition was great. I mean, he was so sweet. And I was like, okay. And then I left.
And they said they didn't have room for
you. I was so confused. And then I went home, and then the season started. And I remember watching the first show and being like, well, I didn't get it. And then after the 4th show, we got a call saying, can she come? So then I started, like, 5th show in, I started, which was... even more nerve-wracking because you feel
like... And
where
were you? You were in L.A.
I was in L.A.
And they call you and they say, get out here.
Yeah.
Had you watched the show prior to that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'd grown up...
You had?
...watching it. Oh, yeah. Especially high school, I remember it was like people would watch it and then
what
talk about
it. What
you
remember of high school?
Yeah, I don't really remember.
I don't remember. So you had an awareness of the show and you were a fan of the show. So when they called you and asked you to come, you felt other than nervous?
Other than nervous, God, I don't know if there was even much more than nervous.
But were you happy?
I was so happy. I was like, this is too good to be true. And in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm moving to New York City. Where do I live? How do I get around? How do I move my stuff? What if I get there and none of my stuff works? You know,
but it's kind of
getting
interesting.
SNL is
it's a huge
deal.
Thing.
I mean, I jumped up and down. I couldn't believe it. And I think the difference with SNL is if I had gotten my big break, whatever you want to call it, if it was a pilot or a TV show got picked up or a movie, you kind of know what to expect. And with SNL, you have no idea.
The script hasn't been written yet.
It hasn't been written. Like, what am I going to do on the show? Right. How does... It's live. It's an hour and a half.
Discovering what to do on SNL wouldn't be a problem for Kristen Wiig. She went on to create some of the most memorable characters the show has ever seen.
My next film is Tim Burton's adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. Or what I like to call it, Alice in Wonder, if someone put LSD in my crystal. Like, what is happening in this thing?
She inhabited her SNL creations with the fierce commitment of a veteran film actor. It's no wonder her transition into movies was so smooth.
Lil, you're getting married.
I'm getting married. And you'll be my maid of honor.
God, of course. Of course I will.
It'll be super fun.
It's going to be really fun. Yeah,
how would Aunt Linda review Bridesmaids? What would Aunt Linda say?
She'd probably be like, there's too many women in it. Oh, God.
Coming up, we'll talk with Kristen about SNL and Bridesmaids, which she starred in and co-wrote, earning her an Oscar nomination for Best Screenplay. Later, I'll be visiting Dick Cavett at his home for a conversation about, among other things, what makes a good conversation.
My advice to you would be continue in what you're doing and don't change anything.
Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
It's Saturday Night Live!
For the past 7 years, Kristen Wiig has consistently made me laugh until tears stream down my face. Before SNL, she did a lot of things. She was a caterer, a waiter, the lady who gave out peach samples at a farmer's market. She painted retail window displays, and she answered phones at a law firm that lasted a day.
Kristen Wiig!
But Kristen and Saturday Night Live, that was a match made to last. Until this past May, when Wiig left the show. Her characters, often exercises in juxtaposition, will be sorely missed. The repulsively friendly Target cashier.
Let's see. Sunscreen, nose plugs. I wear nose plugs around the house when my neighbor cooks broccoli.
The queen of one-upsmanship.
What was your name?
Penelope.
The pathologically nervous travel expert.
I'm not nervous. I just changed my mind about doing this. Just kidding. I didn't change my mind. I changed my clothes. Just kidding. My clothes didn't change, but my address did. And I live at 21 Jump Street. Just kidding. I live at Jumpy 1-2 Street. Just kidding. I didn't move, but I can move my body. Look. Just kidding.
One of the greatest gifts from SNL is getting out of my comfort zone. I realized, I think Lauren realized, probably the first handful of years that I was there, most of my characters were ladies in their 40s with, like, short hair and weird sweaters that nobody
Barbara Bush.
No one wanted at the dinner party. Yeah. And the good thing about SNL for me creatively is to think, okay, I'm comfortable enough. I really want to try something that's not something that I normally do. And that's when I actually first came up with the character, Shanna.
One time, I ate a bunch of peanuts, and I had a pain near my belly button. So the doctor told me he needed a stool sample, and I had to poop in the tiniest, cutest little white cup.
The one that's, like, sexy, but then does, like, gross things. Because I was like, I really want to write a character that looks kind of good, but blank. And that's kind of where the flirting lady came from, too. I was like, I just want to try... You know, I didn't really know what that was going to be. I mean, none of it was really on the page when we wrote it.
But for you, do you feel like when there's a quotient of a character, which is a sensuous quotient, and you're sending it up, do you realize you could walk out the door tomorrow and probably play that character for real in a straight film? I mean, have you ever wanted to play a leading lady in a dramatic film or a love story?
Oh, yeah.
A period film.
I would love to do that.
Straight films.
Yes. I hope I get the opportunity to do that. I was just actually talking to someone about this the other day, that the audience very quickly puts you in a folder. Like, they know you how they first knew you. I'm Kristen from SNL, or a comedic actress. And people are always so surprised when I want to do dramatic stuff. Really?
Yeah.
Like, you really want to do that?
Have you had any offers for that?
I mean, there's a couple things that I'm looking at doing next that aren't comedies at all.
Right.
One of them is really not at all. And
it's a horror movie.
It's a horror movie. I just want to be in like a tub.
Will you do a horror? You ever want to do a horror movie with me?
Are you kidding?
Like a paranormal Blair Witch thing, where just completely loosey goosey, just cameras everywhere, and we improv.
We could shoot it in here.
We could shoot it in here. Yeah.
We're on the radio, and then we just hear voices.
There's like a dead announcer who's in here and locks us in here.
Yeah.
You know, but let's talk about that later on.
Okay, I love that.
Let's Judd Apatow.
Someone's got to be listening to this.
Somebody really good.
With a typewriter.
Not a computer.
No.
A typewriter.
No.
We're old school.
Yeah.
So you wrote Bridesmaids, as everybody knows.
Yes.
Everybody knows.
I co-wrote it.
Okay, yes. You with...
Annie Mamalo.
I don't know Annie, but I know you. And there really is something in this business when you see somebody who is as lovely as you are and as pleasant as you are and as talented as you are and kind of unassuming. I mean, you're not a very self-important, you know, artist in this business. And then all of a sudden you go, whoa! You know, you make a movie that's just this huge success. When you look back on it now, what do you think?
When we were making the movie, it was like, we wrote this thing, we hope it works.
Whose idea was it?
Everyone's having fun, what's going to happen? The original, just the idea of the story was Annie's.
Mm-hmm.
Judd asked me to write something for myself after I did Knocked Up, and he's like, you can write by yourself, you can have a writing partner. Most of the sketches that I wrote at Groundlings with someone else were with Annie, so I just called her and... we'd kind of talk loosely, like, hey, someday we should maybe write a movie. But that's so daunting. I don't know how to write
a movie. I like what you said in the interview. You said, let's write 20 sketches.
Yeah.
Sketches we can do.
Yeah, and then just, like, kind of put them together. So she had this idea, and I was in New York. And so she actually went to Judd's office and, you know, was like, hi, I'm Annie. This is our idea. And he's like, okay, yeah, start writing it. So every hiatus, I would come to L.A., we discovered Skype later, but we like to do everything together. We're not
right.
one of
it's
those
better.
Teams that just says, like, hey, write this and send it to me. We like to do everything together.
So you wrote this for Judd?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
what happened?
And then...
how much notes did you get from somebody else? Or was it all like it was there?
We were writing every day on set, writing alt lines,
fine-tuned.
Writing new
like
jokes.
TV.
Yeah. We would have
like the Groundlings.
Scenes written. He'd be like, okay, write this scene again, but maybe this happens. Or how about instead of these two characters, maybe it's the other two girls that are there. So it was constant writing, rewriting. Every day we would get a packet of scenes from old drafts, scenes that we loved, scenes that, you know, other people's ideas.
Scenes that we refused to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of writing, a lot of writing.
And in terms of the casting, it looks to me like you got everybody you wanted, true?
Yeah. One of the reasons why Annie and I wanted to write this movie was that we know so many funny women from the Groundlings and, you know, women.
Which of those were in the film?
Wendy and Melissa. And Maya's a former Groundling. Ellie and Rose were the only ones that I didn't know before.
And talk about Rose Byrne, who I saw her at the SAG Awards. And, of course, she looks I saw her at the SAG Awards, and she definitely is deer in the headlights when you meet her. She's very sweet. But she is divine, and she's so game. Do you find that all you need to be is a good actor to get the comedy thing, or do you think there's something special to comedy, to playing it?
Well, I think to be game, you have to be willing to not look good, to put it out there, poke fun at yourself.
Yeah.
And Rose is like... she has no improv experience, and she improvised like crazy in this movie. I don't know. I think she's unbelievable.
To play that cotillion kind of broad, we've seen that in a lot of manifestations. But you got to stay with it. You know, you got to never comment on it. And that's what I love. Was she was like, it was acting.
Yeah.
She's like playing this really stick up her, you know what.
Yeah. And Annie and I have always said the Helen character that she played, it was the toughest to figure out because— she's this person that my character instantly hates, but my best friend is very close with her. So you have to see what she sees in her, too. So Rose was that perfect thing of like, oh, God, she's driving me crazy, but, oh, I kind of want to hang out with her.
Yeah.
And she did that.
Women are like that.
Well, not all women.
Like if men are friends and then you have a friend I can't stand, but with men they understand, just don't bring him around.
Yeah, right.
But with women, it's like, you know, come on.
Yeah, bring her over.
Lori's not so bad.
Yeah, and then she comes over and you're like, hi.
Talk about Melissa.
Melissa at the Groundlings was a little ahead of me. From the moment I met her, I just was like, looked up to her and had never seen anyone in my life not only embrace characters like she does, but creates them. The stuff that she's done at the Groundlings is insane. Like, shows sold out when she's, you know, doing her stuff. When she came in to audition for this, it was absolutely perfect. There's something very maternal about Melissa, which was very important in that character. And also, she's just... Can I swear on the show?
Think of a metaphor.
Okay. She's effing brilliant. Can I just say that? We're, like, so lucky that she's in the movie.
Yeah. What are you doing next? Have you got any movies in the can?
I have one movie that's in the can right now called Imogene. I'm a writer in New York. My relationship has just ended. Without giving too much away, people think that I tried to kill myself. And
is it a drama?
It's a drama with comedy in it. And then I have to be released to a family member when I'm in the hospital because they don't have enough room in the hospital. And so I have to go home to my mom, who Annette Bening plays. I haven't seen her or talked to her in, you know, 8-10 years. So it's sort of going back home, finding out what's important, that whole kind of thing.
This is a trite question, but I often think about this myself. Being older than you and coming from a different generation, when I would come in and I would meet people that were not peers of mine, but people that I really admired. But I didn't always work with people that were, you know, on Turner Classic Movies, so to speak. I wasn't making movies with John Garfield, you know, but and William Holden. But when I would meet these people that I deeply admired, it was just such an amazingly resonating experience. And on SNL, you got a different person every week, presumably.
Yeah.
Who are some of the ones that are most memorable to you that you work with? You were like, I can't believe I'm standing here doing my thing with blank.
Well, SNL aside, Annette Bening on this movie, I completely had that with her. I couldn't believe I was doing scenes with her and she was playing my mother. I mean, I can't even.
She's very gifted.
Yeah. Oh my God, SNL, it's like every week.
Yeah, there's different... but can you think of even one or two that you just went, holy...
You.
Beep. No, come on.
Well, a little bit. True. Steve Martin.
Yeah.
When I first met him, I was like, oh my gosh, I've watched you and...
Worshipped you.
Yeah, for most of my life. And that was pretty crazy. And De Niro, when he... hosted was
when he wanders in.
It was it was amazing. Plus, you know what it is? Because you meet people, you go out to parties, whatever, and you meet people. But when people come to SNL, you're seeing such a different side to them because they're not in their element. Some of the more dramatic actors don't have comedy experience, so it's interesting to see people not in their element come on the show and be sort of like, "Tell me what to do."
Kristen's final Saturday Night Live show was an emotional one. Each cast member, one at a time, danced with Kristen. Wig said she would miss SNL in many ways.
It's a two-parter. The people, I'm going to miss seeing all those faces every day. And what the people bring out in me. That creative muscle that you have when you're at SNL, you know, it's so fast-paced. You're putting a puzzle together. And it has to be put together by Saturday at 11:30. And being surrounded by creative people and knowing that you're all in it together and you're putting on a show, pushing this huge boulder together. Every Saturday you do something that you're scared to do. I will miss that feeling.
And, of course, you have absolutely no prospects whatsoever. I mean, it's a really ballsy move on your part because who the F is going to hire you?
I don't know. I may go back to... open up a canoe shop.
Is the goal for you films and it's less kind of factory work like TV can be?
Yeah, I mean, temporarily. I mean, I don't know. I don't like the word goal because I feel like those are always changing for me.
You don't like having goals.
I don't like having goals.
I don't.
That's why I, you know, do what I do. Right. I don't know. I want to direct. I want to live in Paris and paint. I want to do, like, I don't know. I want to do a lot of different things.
Seriously?
Yeah.
You think you could live in Paris?
Yeah.
And
hell
do
yeah.
what?
I don't know.
You'd
eat
last
bread.
In Paris for about 2 months.
That is not true. Well, maybe, but you'd then I'd live in Paris for 2 months. How great would that be?
There you go. You and I are going to have dinner
yeah.
when we talk about the haunted studio movie. That Judd Apatow is going to give us notes on. We'll get together. Also, we'll have another lunch, a separate lunch, to talk about healthy goal making.
Okay.
Healthy, right.
You know. No, what I mean, it's not that I don't think you should have goals. Let me go back. What I'm saying is my life right now is not what I thought it would be 6 months ago.
It's always people like you that
so
end up
like,
on top.
But you never know what's going to happen. And it's so day to day. And I don't know. I don't know.
But I love that you're so blithe about it, but in a healthy way, where you're like, you know, I'm going to leave myself, because that's artistry to me.
No, I never want to stop doing creative things, whatever they may be.
It's all going well.
I can't complain. I'm very happy.
As she should be. Kristen Wiig is preparing to star in upcoming films directed by Sean Penn, Ben Stiller, and Errol Morris. And if things go the way one would suspect, she'll continue to delight us for as long as my next guest has.
The Dick Cavett Show.
Over the course of nearly 5 decades in television, Dick Cavett has perfected the art of the great interview.
Betty Davis.
The Dick Cavett Show debuted in 1968. Here was a small-town Nebraska boy with a Yale education, cultured yet unintimidating. Thoughtful, honestly curious, and funny.
Orson Welles.
He had a knack for gently driving the conversation to the heart of the matter while keeping his guests relaxed.
May I call you Orson again?
Oh, my goodness. Wouldn't it be ridiculous if you didn't?
All right.
Cavett's show could book the brightest and often the most reclusive celebrities of that time. Katharine Hepburn, John and Yoko, Groucho Marx, Orson Welles, Truman Capote. Eventually, Cavett himself was as admired as his guests.
Robert Mitchum.
If one more person had told me how many times you've terrified interviewers, I wouldn't have been able to do this.
I don't feel that I terrify interviewers. They more or less terrify me.
Debbie Reynolds.
You don't mind my asking, do you? It's not rude in Hollywood to ask.
You see, Julia, it's all right. No, you can ask me anything.
No, no, I mean, I know
those
that
are.
All, most
just
young people have their...
Just my hair comes off, but my teeth, though, come out.
I visited Cavett at his house in Montauk, a place called Tick Hall. I've known Cavett for several years as a neighbor out on Long Island.
Take in the vista.
Tick Hall sits atop a remote cliff overlooking the Atlantic. The views are spectacular.
Riley. Hi, Riley.
Cavett's lived here since the 1960s.
For our listeners, here comes that sound you're hearing is the rattle of the iced tea being delivered into the parlor here.
Very attractive employee.
Yes, for this gorgeous.
That's actually his wife, Martha. His first wife, Carrie Nye, died in 2006.
She came with the house.
Eddie and Puffy Morgan.
Cavett got his start in show business writing for the greats of early television. Jack Parr, Merv Griffin, and Johnny Carson. After a few years of this, he decided to start writing for himself, but first, he had to figure out who he was.
And there's a breakthrough point I had when I got what you might call a premise, and I just refound, thank God, a lost letter from Groucho saying, I saw you on the Merv Griffin show the other night and got that old feeling. Seriously, he may have said. I think you've struck a mother lode with your idea of being the Nebraska yokel at Yale.
Is that the card you played?
Well, yes. I started thinking what, you know, always you hear writers must write what they know. Well, what's my life? What do I know? I don't have an unusually large nose. I don't have funny. I'm not short and fat. I can't play off that. I can't. But I did come from the Midwest and go to the Ivy League. Totally contrasting worlds.
There was no Ivy League in your family?
None.
What'd your dad do?
All three of my parents, I also had a stepmother, were teachers. And my dad taught high school. And as he always reminded me when I was going to spend some money on something, your mother and I, in the Depression, had to decide whether to spend a dime on a loaf of bread or if we could go to a movie with it.
Right.
I can't believe that, but it's,
that's
of course
a depression narrow. That was my dad.
Yeah. I've been to, every time I go to Comstock, I try to picture where my dad maybe lived and taught. And but he was rewarded with $900 a year.
Now, what was your relationship to conversation? Meaning, have you always been the conversationalist back home in Nebraska? And then when you went to Yale and...
A month ago on this table, when I was going through old envelopes of stuff, I found three, what do you call them? Report cards from third, fourth, and fifth grade. Miss Gabus, Miss Fuchs, and Mrs. Graham.
And all three of them said, one might imagine how far Dick would get if he'd stop talking in class.
You've hit it. Dick must learn to control his talking is on two of them. And Dick must learn to let others talk occasionally, one of the wittier ones put down.
But you were always someone who, it was a gift you had.
Apparently, yeah. And
did you go to Yale undergrad? You did graduate school as well?
No.
Undergrad only.
Sometimes I'm referred to as a drama school graduate.
You weren't.
I wasn't. I took three courses in the drama school while I was an undergraduate. Directing Miss Welch's speech class, stage speaking, it's theory and practice, and a theater history class taught by a humorless German, if that isn't too redundant.
You mentioned his name when I saw you. What was his name?
Alois Nagler.
Alois Nagler.
He was kind of good. He looked like Rex Harrison, but spoke like Himmler.
What was my other favorite name you told me the other day? Ola?
Oh, Orson Welles' beautiful, beautiful girlfriend I met in the, right in that part of the plaza lobby that Cary Grant pauses at in the beginning of North by Northwest and Essential. And he said, Dick, this is my lady friend, Oya Palancash.
Oya Palancash.
This is Oya Palancash. And I thought, I'm going to remember that name
yes.
as long as
I can. I'm going to Google it as soon as I get home.
God, I'd love to know the details of his life in all those years when he'd make a film, not quite finish it, move on, live off some countess somewhere, and then his next address would be in Spain, and the next one would be in
Mexico.
Dunkirk. And God, what a life. Mad, strange, wasted, gigantic amount of talent. Now, obviously not totally wasted because he did a lot of films, but in a doctor's office, I picked up a New Republic. And it was an article that began, someday theater historians will have to deal with the problem of what Marlon Brando and Orson Welles did to their bodies. And he parallels their two careers, the wastedness, the bad choices,
early
the contempt
genius.
For the business sure. that they love to express.
When I was going to do a television show, I was 10 years too old for the part. I was 40, and they wanted me to do Brick and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
You were 10 years
too old. I was 40, and Brick should be, you know, hovering around 30, late 20s. So they wanted me to do this for CBS and have Brando play Big Daddy. So I contacted him, and he says, when would you like to get together? I said, I'd like to get together with you this week, quite frankly, because I'm leaving for Africa. And he said, sure, come over to the house on Thursday at 1 o'clock. I went to his house.
12,500 Mulholland Drive.
I went to Mulholland Drive, yeah, and had lunch with him for nearly 4 hours at his house.
Talk about people who talk.
And he talked about his weight gain and his physical problems. He talked about it like it was an airbag, like it just, like one day. And it wasn't until he was morbidly obese did he say, well, maybe I'm not doing so well. But when you did the show with him, because I watched so many of your shows.
He wasn't very terribly fat then. He had a gut.
Yeah, he was a little blocky. But the funny thing about him is there's later Brando, you know, the very end. And there's him with Larry King. And he's very playful and he's very childlike. Mm-hmm. But with you when he was on, he seemed very feral on the show. Was he that way off camera? He seemed like he was going to throw a punch any minute now.
I know. And the, alternating with that million-dollar grin that my director admitted he couldn't cut away from it to do a reaction shot. He was so hypnotized by that fabulous grin of his.
But he seemed angry.
Other people said the show seemed like pulling teeth, and what do you bring the dreary Indians on for, and all this stuff. It was a very difficult evening, and if I had it to do again, I didn't resist him any, except at one point, Well, I got a laugh that he didn't get until he heard the audience laugh, it looks like, when I've seen it back, which was, what about the success of the movie Godfather? And he said, normally we won't talk about movies. And the audience laughed, because that's one thing you would talk to a big movie star about. And then he grinned. He gave through that anomalous grin, like, I know what this must mean to you. So then I said, how about the book, The Godfather? And he knew to laugh at that point. And the other one was his belittling, iced tea rattling, belittling of the art of acting. And now, you know, anybody can do it, you know. Once he said to me, you know, your mom said, who peed on the toilet seat? And you say, I didn't do it. And you're acting then.
Yeah. You know. Yeah, I come into his house and he says, and we're sitting there, and I'm completely numb.
Yeah,
he comes in a
moo-moo. At first you are.
He comes in a moo-moo, and we're in his house. It's a very hallucinatory moment for me. He looks at me and says, you and I are like two dogs sniffing each other right now. And he says, I'd like to make an arrangement with you, an agreement with you, where you say whatever you want to say and ask me whatever you want to ask me, and I'll say whatever I want to say, and I'll ask you whatever I want to ask you. We'll just talk about whatever we want to talk about. It'll make us feel comfortable.
That is so him. But I know what you mean when you first met him. If you can stop the voice in your head saying, Jesus Christ, this is Marlon Brando that I'm sitting with, and he's so aware of that. My first talk with him was on the phone, where we are now, in fact. He called, I was told he would at a certain time. And we talked with the sun about 15 degrees above the horizon until well after the moon had risen.
Coming up after a break, more with TV legend Dick Cavett, a man who knows exactly what to do when an interview guest is truly awful.
Be sure you have Mel Brooks sitting there.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and here's the thing. Take a listen to our archive, more unexpected conversations with artists, writers, policymakers, and performers.
Mind if I throw up on this table?
No,
is that a problem?
Musicians, we expect strange behavior from musicians.
Yeah.
How long does this go on, by the way?
Listen to as much as you like at hearsthething.org. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. He's a television legend, but Dick Cavett's also acted in movies and on Broadway, hosted a radio show, and written several books. His latest is a memoir called Talk Show. Cavett's recollections of specific episodes and guests are incredibly candid and clear, as if they happened yesterday.
The good was, of course, always welcome, and I had no reason to think that James Mason would be the first person I ever had on a show, on my daytime show, who was so enchantingly charming talking, without any sense of putting on the charm, that I missed all signals to go to commercial. And it was the first time that I broke through reading my notes off to the guest, barely able to hear what they were saying for reasons of nerves and signals that I just missed over their shoulder. And, oh, my God, someone lettered a card and took it back. And, oh, God, the guest's lips have stopped moving. Do you have any hobbies? The disappointing guests were writers. Now, I loved having writers on. I did a boy's dream, some boys' dreams, Updike and Cheever on the same show, Cheever separately, Updike separately, Saul Bellow. I had them all.
But who didn't cut it as a talk show guest?
But the thing was that, you couldn't believe that this semi-articulate person, having trouble with vocabulary, seemingly, and just outlandish, unbelievable thing, had written that glorious prize-winning prose that you read. Now, the exceptions were, of course, many. Truman Capote, questionably accurate but entertaining guest at all times.
You had Olivier on the show, correct?
Yes. It was a 90-minute show in London. And then I did him again in New York in the Wyndham Hotel with Lady Olivier, Joan Plowright. So I got two with Olivier.
How was that?
Well, it was fine. What was so interesting,
it's an interesting
about
word.
Meeting him?
Was it fine? What do you mean?
It was the opposite of bad. I think was what I was trying. You can't pick on a guy's choice of words. I swore to God recently that I would never say the word awesome in my life.
Sure.
And if we could only make that true of everyone in the world, that would be swell. It can go along with iconic and closure and like, of course, and a few others. Amazing. We all are saying amazing all the time. Now, I got five amazings in watching morning television for about 40 minutes the other day. Amazing guest. We have just an amazing script. It's just amazing. I was amazed by it.
Your career amazes me.
Yeah, but Olivier was terrific, and he was such a clown. Afterward, not on the air. He could have done so more on the air, and it would have been wonderful. I think I was probably a little too in awe, I didn't say awesome, to get all the fun out of him that I later learned is in there.
Who were the people today that you sit there and say, God, if I was doing it now, that seemed like it could be fun?
I almost wish you hadn't asked me that,
well,
because here's how that thought occurred to me. I was on a radio show plugging the book. It was Mark Simone, and he said, "This you must get Cavett's DVDs. There's one called Hollywood Greats, he may have said, tell us who's on it." And I thought, what a dirty trick. I won't be able to think of two of them now. But I had it sitting there on my messy table. And here's who's on it. It has all of Katharine Hepburn, Betty Davis, Fred Astaire, Kirk Douglas, Lucille Ball, Frank Capra.
Noel Coward.
Coward isn't on that one, damn it. That needs a separate one, too. Robert Mitchum, Orson Welles, John Huston, and Marlon Brando. And I looked at this. Did I mention Lucille Ball? And I thought two things. Am I the only one in this cover of this box who's alive? No, Kirk Douglas is. But what I really thought was, who are their counterparts now? What list of today's greats would include that many redwoods?
Even in politics. Politics, writing, is there anybody, authors?
No, I think we live in an age of increasing mediocrity.
So you don't sit there and say, I would love to have had Richard Holbrooke on, I'd love to have...
There are plenty of people. Yeah, God, yes. Meryl Streep belongs on anybody's list of greats. You know, but I don't think quite so many achieve. Maybe you can't be big in the way those people were, these giant people.
Yeah.
Do they grow redwoods anymore?
No.
Do they just grow smaller sequoias or pines?
Yeah, zelkovas.
Conifers of some sort.
Yeah. Well, the media is like a train. You know, I mean, it used to be a train was a glamorous, gleaming thing that wasn't up. Now a train is a filthy vessel you get in when you can't drive a car.
That raises a question completely outside show business. But when I was a kid, I marveled that Japan had a 200-mile-an-hour, the Shinkansen bullet train, and we still have the Long Island Railroad, and I'm 50 years older.
Yeah. It's a great country, though, isn't it?
Otherwise.
America.
Yeah. It is, yes.
You obviously have had your difficulties, and you've talked about it. No. You're looking over your shoulder like, no, that's somebody else. And I know for me, when I was getting divorced and I was in the real nadir of the whole experience, I felt horrible. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets down. Everybody has the blues. Everybody suffers losses. You can not only have a bad game, you can have a bad season.
Yeah.
But then when do you decide that you need help from someone clinically?
Since memory is affected by depression, there are details like that that you're not absolutely sure of. But I know that one time I knew was that when I boarded the Concorde and realized I'm not going to be this sick in another country and got off.
Yeah.
And I called my shrink and he said, well, you can either get on the next plane or go to Colombia. And my staff was already over there. And I just thought, I can't go away feeling this horrible. A stewardess took one look at me and said, you want to get off? And I said, yeah. I mean, she saw whatever it was. It was that clear. Now, let me ask you this. Did you work during any of this? Were you able to work?
I had to work, yeah. I had to work. And work somehow helped me a bit.
I can tell you a quickie that involves two people we've already named. I was at the Brando residence. You might have just left one day. And I told him about taping a show with Olivier in the Wyndham Hotel for PBS. And I said, I was so depressed while doing it. And it's being Olivier made me realize how depressed I was, because when I got to the hotel and they took me to a room and we were going to tape in the room up above, I thought, Laurence Olivier is one story above me and I don't give a damn. I just want to go home and get under the rug. And there are some cue cards. What do they say? Oh, I'll start it over again. How can they be so cruel to get me out of bed and to do this? And sitting there with the Oliviers, having read a prompter, a cue card introduction, the chat started. And I had some notes off camera. But I thought, this is awful. They're going to come over any moment and say, Dick, it's all right. We'll send them home, or we'll send you home and they're home. You know, we'll get them back on another day. This is obviously not a good day for you. The other thought rushing through my head was, they can see I am nuts. My brain is cracked. They can see it. I must be taking 20-second pauses from when they speak until I do. And I must be just hanging there with my head. I better raise my head a little. And Olivier is quite smart enough in the psychology of performing and so on to know that he's got a dingbat on his hands.
Yeah.
And this is just...
He's flying solo here.
Yeah.
His co-pilot's asleep in the cabin.
I hope Robin, my producer, will come over and say it's all right. But I realized I had finished it. And I was telling Brando that, and he said, I said, how awful it was. And he said, did you ever see that show? And I said, oh, God, are you kidding? No. Do me a favor. Go home and look at it. This is half a year later. Longer. I was well then. So I went home and looked at it, and I was fine.
Yeah. It's all that's going on
there. There were no pauses. Then I saw him again and reported that to him. And I said, how did you know? What is that? I didn't have hesitations. I came right in. I looked interested, which I wasn't. My eyes were sparkling, which I were no reason. And I looked like I was having the best time with the Oliviers anyone could have with anybody. He said, automatic pilot.
Yeah.
I've had to resort to it a lot.
Yeah.
Takes over. So had I stayed home that day and not taped the Oliviers, I would have stayed in bed. And could not, if I'd been taped there, I wouldn't have looked good. But some part of us who are in the business, something won't let you, some crazy way, be a total mess while you're working.
Well, there's two of us. Yeah, we have two sides, those two sides.
I saw it with Judy Garland, who was, I think, on my show for her last television appearance, the 68 daytime show. ABC erased them all, used them to tape, but let's make a deal. It might be, somebody has a bumpy home tape of that. She was so wonderful.
You talk about these tapes, by the way, I want to get back to that.
Oh,
whenever
yes.
Whenever you talk about these tapes, and you got the rights to the ABC
There's several versions of what really happened. I just remember being told one day, Dick, they're going to either reuse the tapes or erase them or dump them.
And when you say that...
What tapes? The ones to the ABC show. And you can have them if you want to for $60 each. And I thought, well, that's a ludicrous amount of money.
Yeah.
And a guy on my staff, unfortunately, but he did it quite well, went through them and eliminated those he thought would never be of any interest again, and it turns out some of them would have been. but I have most all of them.
But not, thank God he didn't rely on you for that choice, because you would have said to him, well, you can get rid of the Olivier, because I was zonked throughout that.
Yeah, throw out that one.
Thank God.
I was fine for the first Olivier one.
When you talk about those ABC tapes, I in my mind, visualize the guys throwing the sled on the fire, you know, and it burning. I see these guys with boxes of tapes. What are we supposed to do with these tapes, Charlie?
Yeah.
And somebody said, I don't know, the Cabot Show. I mean, what the hell is that? Ray said, throw it in the fire.
You're too realistic.
Bum, bum, bum.
Yeah. God, the losses. Goes, well, you know, the Sons of B***s erased most of Johnny Carson's New York shows, years of them, number of which I was on. Love to see them.
What's your relationship to television now? Is there any of it you watch? Is there anything you like? Is there?
I'm rapidly
where do you get your news
gotten
from?
So I don't associate television with entertainment very much.
Yeah.
And
no
this
TV
is a
viewing
total,
now.
Total 360 degrees. When we got television in Nebraska, I watched it every evening. I could tell you now. CBS, NBC, and ABC's schedules for every night of the week back then. I watched everything, and a lot of it was good. I wasn't just watching crap. I watched Studio One, I watched Robert Montgomery, Philco Theater, The Web, and of course Gleason and all the variety shows. The
Sammy comics. Spear and his orchestra!
Les Brown and his Band of Renown, and now here's the star of our show, Bob Hope. And I get goose pimples even now.
You can read Dick Cavett's blog, a word he admits he had to look up before he started writing one, on the New York Times website. This is Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is produced by Emily Boteen and Kathy Russo, with support from Jim Briggs, Wendy Dore, Ed Herbstman, Melanie Hoops, and Monica Hopkins. Thanks to Trey Kay, Lou Olkowski, and Larry Josephson and the Radio Foundation. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.